Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and back with me this week we have Spike's editor Tom Slater.
Hello.
And Spike columnist Joanna Williams.
Hi.
Coming up on today's show, we'll be discussing the return of Trump, the World Economic Forum, and the man who's obsessed with nappies. So Donald Trump romped home to victory in the Iowa caucuses this week. He got more than 51% of the vote, comfortably beating his fellow Republican rivals, you know, by more than 30 points or around 30 points compared to like Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley. I mean, Tom, there's been alarm bells going off in the establishment, in Democratic circles for a long time about the return of Trump. I mean, but now it feels like it really could happen.
Oh, definitely.
It's nailed on.
And at the same time, you wonder, why is it setting off alarm bells in the sense of why didn't they expect this to happen? I mean, Donald Trump's candidacy was to such a large extent revived by the establishment attempt to take him down. If you look about where his polling numbers were when the Mar-a-Lago raid happened, and it slowly starts to kind of creep up, and then you see the ridiculous indictments in New York, and this one thing after another, whether it's these string of legal cases, some more serious than others, some less spurious than others, but nevertheless clearly weaponized against him. Whether it's the constant kind of absurd fear-mongering that he's going to become a dictator if he takes the presidency again. All of it has been a complete boon to him. It's made crystal clear to his supporters that they're out to get him, essentially, because they are. You know, you can quibble about, you know, which of the methods are more legitimate, but that is what is actually taking place. And it's entirely kind of burnished his narrative. He was always going to have certain, shall we say, strengths going into this particular primary. He does kind of have that sort of status of the incumbent. He is also, you know, during his time as president, really kind of cemented his support amongst evangelicals and others. You can kind of talk about those bits and bobs. But in terms of giving him the thing that people really didn't think he would be able to recapture, which is that populist insurgency, that sense that he was there to rattle the establishment, he's been handed that on a platter. And I thought that was really demonstrated by the fact, I think it was a week before the Iowa caucuses, rather than be campaigning in Iowa, he decided to show up at this DC hearing to sit and watch as his appeal about whether or not he could be let off on the grounds of presidential immunity. He didn't need to be there, but it was quite clear that he knew that that was such a strength for him. So, yes, he's conquering all before him. Looking at the polls, it looks like going to New Hampshire is going to be a similar story, although these things can be quite hard to poll. It's still very much his party. And I think you really can't underestimate how much he's been gifted the momentum he has at the moment from people who've been desperately trying to take him down by any means necessary these past 2 years.
Definitely. Joe, what have you made of it?
Yeah, I think Tom's absolutely right. I think Trump's success is very much because of the efforts to bring him down rather than despite the court cases. But I think the establishment in America have handed Trump this victory for another reason as well, which is just how completely dire Biden's presidency has been.
Yeah.
And I think people are now looking back upon Trump's time in office far more favourably and looking at in whatever measure you take, whether that's economic success of the domestic economy or in terms of international relations, in terms of the border and immigration and every single measure, they're reassessing almost Trump's legacy and seeing it as being something far more positive than anything that's happened in the US over the past 4 years. I mean, I have to say, this part of me does find it a little bit depressing. I mean, the prospect of these two very elderly men having this runoff, my preference would have been Ron DeSantis. But, you know, if you're a Democrat, you have to accept the will of the people. And, you know, the Americans clearly want Trump to be the front runner for the Republican Party. And, you know, that's what it's going to be. And there's no point kind of kicking back against that. We've got to accept that and go with that and look and support the American people in that choice.
Tom, I mean, what have you made of some of the other candidates? I mean, you know, DeSantis' failure probably would have been a surprise a year ago. Nikki Haley has done quite well representing sort of older Republican establishment that Trump swept away so forcefully in 2016. What do you make of the others?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Nikki Haley has been fascinating because there's been so much of a desire to make her a thing, to make her the primary challenger because of the fact that she's the sort of candidate that sort of Republican establishment can get on board with. Even kind of liberal media would give her a bit more of a fair hearing unless she actually became the candidate, in which case she would be, you know, to the right of Genghis Khan probably as far as they were concerned. But nevertheless, I thought it was very telling, though, that Trump won in Iowa amongst basically every kind of demographic constituency, apart from those with advanced degrees, which is amongst who Nikki Haley was obviously the favourite. So I think that tells you a little bit about what she represents and the sort of support that she's drawing. DeSantis is an interesting one. I mean, there's all kinds of arguments as people are marshalling as to why his candidacy has kind of stalled so much. I think he is right in saying that the indictments have sucked all of the oxygen out of the race. The debates certainly felt like a sideshow, just a kind of bolt-on to the ongoing story of Donald Trump and his battle through the courts and so on. And I think that's something which was always going to be really difficult to overcome. It was always going to be really difficult to be the one who kind of follows on from Trump anyway because of the authority that he stamped on the Republican Party. In a very short space of time, it has really become his party. And so it'd be one thing to try and inherit that. It's another thing to go toe-to-toe with him in a primary to try and wrench it from him. I also think Sean Collins made some good points this week about the points at which DeSantis could try and basically go on the offensive a bit more around COVID authoritarianism, which obviously Trump vacillated on, whereas DeSantis was very much a kind of consistent critic of these sorts of things that he could actually try to leverage. He kind of hasn't, for fear of winding up the base too much. Maybe that was a miscalculation. And I think there's also some arguments people say about the thing about DeSantis is whilst he's really great on the culture war and COVID and so on, there were certain bits of the Trump factor, the Trump coalition, which he didn't really understand as a more traditional Republican in certain respects. So you see Trump going after him on Social Security and things like that. And that was one thing that really helped Trump in those states that had voted for Obama twice and then voted for him, was the fact that he was talking about ring fencing Social Security. He wasn't a kind of Paul Ryan Republican and so on. So there's all these different things in the mix. But again, I come back to that point about whilst Trump was always going to be very strong going into this anyway, he has been handed such a boost by dint of this attempt to take him off the ballot by any means necessary. And I think that you can't count that out of the equation here, definitely.
I think one thing that's really interesting is if you listen to kind of sound bites from just regular American citizens when journalists ask them their opinion, or one thing that the Trump supporters always flag up is that he's, and this is a kind of curious quote, and I really had to think about it carefully when I first heard it, but they say, oh, he's not a politician. And in a way, I think kind of DeSantis is almost held back a bit by being in office. And I think what serves Trump well is the fact that not only is he being kind of persecuted by the establishment, but the very fact that he is not in office at the moment anywhere in any formal capacity means that he's not kind of tainted by being seen to be a politician. And I think it's a real sign of the extent to which kind of America's broken, really, how there's that kind of enormous chasm between the political elite in the US and the regular voters, and that lack of trust that's there, and that kind of suspicion around all establishment figures. And I think perhaps that's one thing that DeSantis just doesn't get. I don't think he really appreciates the extent to which that gap's there, and kind of by playing along as a politician, as part of the establishment, he's not speaking to those kind of regular voters who are really seeing society as being broken and just not working in their best interests at all.
Yeah, and it's bigger than wokeness and extends to economics and trade and all those Absolutely. Other things that Trump is trying to speak to. I mean, one thing it's worth drawing on is the rhetoric. Trump is Hitler, Trump is a fascist. That has ramped up in particular in recent weeks. We saw it recently with Biden's sort of semi-unofficial campaign launch. Tom, I mean, it's not going to work, firstly, but, you know, isn't that just as dangerous as what they claim Trump is up to?
Oh, definitely. I mean, because it's all part of the demonization campaign or the Get Trump campaign. It's worth remembering that this is what they were saying in 2016 as well. You know, there were people openly calling him a fascist and so on was something that has been with us for a long time. This isn't just a legacy of January 6th, which, as we all know, has been turned from what it was, which was a very kind of mindless and undemocratic sort of riot, effectively, amongst a bunch of Trump's very hardcore supporters, to being a supposed insurrection, the moment in which America almost ceased to be a democracy, all of the ridiculous things that Joe Biden's been saying. Of course, he gave a speech recently on the third anniversary of January 6th, which they've very consciously tried to turn into as if it's on the status of 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or something, which is completely ridiculous. So they have been saying that for a long time. I think that's why none of this stuff tends to wash. And in this demonization campaign, in this Get Trump campaign, they have demonstrated that while Trump, of course, he's got illiberal, undemocratic, anti-democratic tendencies. You know, there's not a race he hasn't lost that he hasn't claimed wasn't rigged. I was reminded that even when he lost the Iowa caucuses back in 2016, he accused Ted Cruz of stealing it. So this is, you know, this is a pattern of behavior, shall we say. But his kind of panto-authoritarianism, I think, just pales into insignificance when compared to that elite authoritarianism, that elite anti-democracy. The fact that there are at least two US states which currently have formally removed him from the ballot because of some ridiculous kind of Civil War era statute that they're trying to apply, I think tells you where the real threat comes from. I mean, the Democrats have basically convinced themselves they need to destroy American democracy in order to save it. And in that context, it's a lot harder actually to criticize Trump for the undemocratic things he has done, because the other lot has been spending so much time just showing him how it's really done, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that keys into a sort of broader, you know, not just anti-Trump agenda, but, you know, think of many of the things revealed in the Twitter files, the suppression of, you know, COVID so-called misinformation. Often, sometimes that was true information or speculation about lab leaks and things like that, which, you know, people surely have a right to debate. And you do see the other side, the liberal side, as actually exposing itself as quite authoritarian and quite dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the important point, though, is just the extent to which this actually really plays well for Trump. It certainly doesn't stop people wanting to vote for him. You know, now I may be giving him too much credit here, but you almost wonder whether he's aware of this fact and aware that it plays well for him. So when he talks about how he'll be, should he be elected president, he'll be a dictator for a day, you know, without that kind of clever pause in there. You know, he knows that this language will then be echoed over the airwaves, that it will fuel panics from among the elite. But I think he also knows that that panic in and of itself will kind of prove the point he's trying to make and will show that he's not a member of the establishment and play well with the people who are going to vote for him.
So the World Economic Forum kicked off this week, as ever, in the sleepy skiing town of Davos in Switzerland. Tom, one of the notable things this year is that the Labour Party is returning in a big way. They've sent some of their heaviest hitters, particularly Rachel Reeves. Mm-hmm. They're very keen to show that they're clued up with the world of business, with the elites, with the royals and various NGOs, the kind of people who attend this this annual sort of jamboree. I mean, what have you made of that?
I think it's just confirmed all of our suspicions about Labour, which is that they really see their role as returning British politics to its like factory reset, which is, to use a very loaded term when you're talking about the WEF. But resets aside, the point here is the fact that, you know, for a very long time, Davos did embody the way politics was done in the kind of post-Third Way era. This idea that political decision-making is really something which is stitched up between corporations, NGOs, and the technocratic state, and occasionally the public get a look in every so often at an election. That was kind of the way in which things were decided, and everything else just got flowed from there. There's always a lot of grandstanding. There's always a lot of ridiculous talk that never really amounted to much action, a lot of virtue signalling and so on. But that was still a kind of way that they thought politics was done. And Keir Starmer has explicitly said that that's the way in which he likes to do politics. It was this time last year, I think, that he was asked by Emily Maitlis whether he preferred Westminster or Davos, and he, without hesitating, said Davos. And I think that tells you something. I mean, we all know, obviously, there's this attempt to use this as a way to signal we're not going to scare business, we're here to court private sector investment and so on. But I think the subtext to it also is the fact that they are very much of that technocratic mind, very much of a sort of way of doing politics, which we thought we'd started to move away from, or at least there had been some pretty incredible revolts against in the course of the past few years. So I think more than anything, it just demonstrates that Starmer feels like it's about bringing things back to when everything was nice and done behind closed doors in glitzy conference rooms or on nice Davos conference stages, rather than actually involving the mucky business of having to deal with ordinary people and what they think and want things to happen.
I mean, Joe, can it ever go back to normal? I mean, there's been some really interesting reporting from Davos saying that the shadow of Trump hangs over it because, you know, he might come back in at the end of 2024.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, Tom was making the point in relation to the US elections that in order to, they're going to kill democracy, in effect, in order to save it. And I think we see that exact thing playing out in Davos right now. There is so much panic about democracy, essentially. Mm. And the fact that in so many countries around the world this year, it just so happens, coincidentally, elections are going to take place. And really what you've got is elite fear of the masses absolutely on display. And there's a fear of Trump winning in the US, but also in elections all around the world that there may be a populist uprising that might threaten their technocratic control. Mm. I mean, I'm almost loath to use the word technocratic because they're such useless technocrats. Yeah. You know, they're so incompetent. Yeah. You kind of think if it was one good thing about technocracy, it would be that at least, you know, the trains would run on time or, you know, things might work. But we've got this incompetent elite, and essentially all they're doing is fueling panic about democracy in order to safeguard their own position. Mm. And a lot of this seems to be focusing upon panic around the rise of misinformation and disinformation. I mean, we've been there a lot before with these kind of panics. But I think one thing that's quite noticeable is that I think he's the kind of chair of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, in his opening address, he talked about the problem of mistrust.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's kind of realised that, you know, people don't trust these elites. But the problem is he talks about the need to regain trust. But everything they say and do further undermines trust.
Yeah.
And this is the whole bind I think they're in. The more they go around propagating this panic around misinformation and disinformation, essentially what they're telling people is don't trust anything that you read. You know, don't trust anything that you see on the news. You know, trust few things that we say, but other than that, you can't trust anything. So they're kind of talking about democracy while killing democracy.
Mm.
And they're talking about trust while killing trust. And I think really we need the end of the World Economic Forum, quite frankly.
Yeah, misinformation was a big theme of Ursula von der Leyen's speech, the unelected president of of the European Commission, also terrified about what the European elections might mean for democracy. I mean, the irony is too much to bear sometimes, you know, and these people very explicitly don't care about democracy.
I think what they're aware of is that they are just completely unable to motivate anyone or very, very few people to actually go out and vote for them. One of the most pathetic articles I read this week was on Politico about the European Council. I don't think they'd even approached her yet, but absolutely desperate to try and get Taylor Swift to come out and make some statement about the importance of voting in the European elections. I just say, how embarrassing and how desperate can you get to try and think that you've got no policies, no ideas, nothing that can motivate people to get out and vote for you. So all you can do is hope that someone like Taylor Swift comes along and sprinkles a bit of stardust over your election.
Tom?
I think the point about democracy is spot on, because that is really what terrifies the elites. It terrifies them when they're gathered at Davos. But also, if you think about some of the commentary over the new year, and there was a lot of looking forward to the year of elections, because you know, almost half the world's population are going to go to the ballot box this year. It was treated as a terrifying prospect because what if they vote in politicians that we dislike? But it is just fascinating. Whereas amongst all this hand-wringing about democracy, which is really just a code word for technocracy or their way of doing politics, but amongst all this hand-wringing about democracy, it's coming from people who have no democratic legitimacy whatsoever.
Yeah.
Ursula von der Leyen, who precisely no one ever voted for to take up a particular position. She presides over a European Union which has a parliament, but it's basically just a faux democratic window dressing for an incredibly illiberal and authoritarian and anti-democratic institution. You've got the World Economic Forum, which explicitly talks about itself as a forum in which stakeholders can get together and decisions can be made, in which policy will effectively be formed and enacted, if not properly, formally so. And yet it has zero legitimacy whatsoever. So... Yeah. It's an absurd spectacle, but I think it just shows you what a kind of upside down world these people operate in. What's interesting though is that they are aware of their illegitimacy in that sense. Yeah. And that's positive in a strange sort of way. But the fact that they can carry on making these kind of pronouncements without any glint of irony just underlines how detached and, you know, up on high they still are, I guess.
Definitely. I mean, I think the net zero obsession
shows
that yet again. When, you know, in Germany right now, in so many European countries, you've got this rebellion coming from farmers, from ordinary citizens against the net zero proposals. And yet still these leaders gather in Davos and kind of bang on about the importance of net zero. It just shows how completely out of touch they are.
Mm. Yeah, I think John Kerry was talking about, you know, this being the most dangerous year for climate. It obviously isn't, you know, fewer people are dying from climate related events than have in any time in the past 100 years. You had they always invite some indigenous person on to do a little panpipe solo or something like that as a comment on the environment. And in years past, you know, Greta has been addressing the World Economic Forum. That's, you know, what grassroots activism looks like, apparently. But climate change does seem to be, and I think you've noticed this certainly since, you know, Brexit and Trump, it does seem to be the way they're trying to reassert their authority over the public, over political life. Mm.
And when Kerry says it's going to be a bad year for climate change, what it means is it's going to be a bad year for climate change zealotry.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that there are already all these revolts against these diktats. And I think the climate example is so perfect because that's one area in which they're like, we know you don't want this, but you're going to get it anyway.
Yeah.
And the fact that that's being pushed back against is what terrifies them so much. So yeah, it's a perfect example, I think, of how just on another planet they are.
Definitely. So apologies to anyone about to eat their dinner, but we're going to talk about a man from South Tyneside, and he's been charged with some really very disturbing and strange crimes. So it's alleged that he was, among other things, dumping soiled adult nappies at nurseries. Now, the reason we want to talk about this story is because much of the media have decided to describe him as a woman. He calls himself Abby Taylor, and Sky News and other outlets have gone along with this. Local newspaper have described him as a South Shields woman. Even the sort of anti-woke Daily Mail have given him she, her pronouns. I mean, Joe, what do you make of this bizarre trend? I mean, isn't the point of journalism to tell the truth and to report the facts as they are? And this, anyone who can see the picture of this man can see it's a man.
Absolutely. I mean, what this really is deference to perverts.
Mm.
You know, why should we go around kind of doffing the cap, if you like, to the feelings of these male perverts? I can think of no other word for it. You know, this is not the first case, obviously. There's been numerous cases of these men who fancy themselves as women, you know, who make don't even go so far as to make the effort to shave, you know, and commit these gross acts of sexual indecency, and yet then get treated as if their feelings, how they like to be called, the pronouns they prefer to use, is suddenly what's all important. You know, I think there is a bit of misinformation, to go back to the previous discussion, about kind of what the law is in this instance, or, you know, what the press regulatory authorities expect. You almost get the impression that some media outlets think that the law says that they have to refer to men who commit these offences as women, if that's their preferred pronouns. But as far as I'm aware, there's no law in the land that says that you have to legally respect in print and in media reporting as somebody's preferred pronouns. I think you're absolutely right, Fraser. The only moral commitment that journalists should have is to tell the truth. And if somebody's a man, then you have a moral responsibility, I think, to use male pronouns and actually say the truth as you see fit. I mean, it kind of creates all kinds of horrible situations where kind of statistically it makes it appear as if women are committing more sex crimes than they actually are. But I think for me, the worst possible examples of this is where some of these cases have actually gone to court and women victims have actually been made to stand up in court and refer to their attacker as she, her penis. For me, that's where this is morally reprehensible, to actually make a woman who's been a victim of one of these crimes lie about the person who attacked her. I think it's just really disgusting.
Definitely. Tom?
No, I think it's just one of the great contradictions of journalism at the moment, which is there is all this panic about misinformation and fact-checking and the idea that everything is so post-truth that, you know, everyone's just making their own reality, talking all this nonsense and pretending like it's actually true. And yet, time and again, outlets across the political spectrum genuflect to this ideology and treat the seeming self-ID of really quite depraved individuals as if it's holy writ. And it's to the point where you've got a headline and an image which so clearly contradict one another in terms of describing this gentleman as a woman. And also just the types of crimes. These are crimes that are, you know, the vast majority of these kinds of things are committed by men. Mm. We all know that. That's statistically the case. So insult to people's intelligence doesn't really capture it. It is deranging. It is,
yeah.
People must think, what the hell is going on? And there's been a string of cases like this, as Joe was saying. Often it's cases of paedophiles or rapists and so on, where they've just been presented in a news article as woman does X or woman does Y. There's one from a few years ago, which kind of was on a par with this one, which was woman jailed for having cocaine-fueled sex with an Alsatian, accompanied by a picture of a bloke with stubble in a wig. You just think, you're the journalist writing that piece and putting it together. You know that what you're saying is absolutely absurd, and yet people feel compelled to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And it's that bit, why they feel so compelled to do it anyway, which I find so bemusing but also fascinating.
But I suppose, that is a requirement of trans ideology, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you believe in self-ID, then how could anyone be lying? You must agree to, you know, what someone says there is their truth.
Absolutely. And I mean, this was very well illustrated in the Scottish case of Isla Bryson, which just so happened to hit at the exact same time that they were debating the possibility of self-identification in Scotland. And you remember, I mean, it was quite beautiful to see Nicola Sturgeon tying herself up in knots, trying to say that Isla Bryson, was a rapist, not a woman. But that point at what point did he stop becoming a woman?
Yeah.
You know, was the point at which he was accused or found guilty of rape? And you can't have it both ways, which was what Sturgeon was trying to do. You know, there is a part of me, though, thinks that you're absolutely right. You know, this is the logic of transgender ideology. But in a way, the very fact that we're having this discussion, which we must do, we must talk about this, but they've kind of won, because what we're all now talking about is the correct pronouns that these people should go by, whether they're male or female. It becomes a distraction, if you like, from the actual offence that these men have committed. The only thing really that we should be talking about in relation to Isla Bryson, I can't remember the male name.
Adam Graham,
thank you, is the rape.
Yeah.
You know, that he should be being absolutely condemned as a rapist. Instead, the very fact that we have to get into these discussions about whether, you know, the correct way to address him is as Isla or Adam, as he or she, kind of hands a victory to these transgender ideologues, because we're not then associating these people with the gross acts they've committed.
Definitely. And Tom, anything else?
I think it's just another reminder of how the capture, as is often talked about, of various institutions has happened without, or has certainly preceded, any sort of formal legal change.
Mm.
I mean, the Isla Bryson scandal was so fascinating because of the fact that you had the Scottish government trying to bring in gender self-ID, and then this revelation that gender self-ID was already effectively rolled out across the Scottish prison service.
Yeah.
And in fact, even in English prisons, where this shift hadn't been made as explicit, there were horrendous cases of male sex offenders and rapists being put in the women's estate. Similarly with journalists, as you say, Joe, they're almost working under the misapprehension that they'll be prosecuted if they misgender someone, even a pervert who leaves adult nappies outside of nurseries. And yet that's obviously not the case. But what seems to have happened is that these activists managed to influence these institutions anyway. Or something which is even more chilling is that these institutions genuflect to this ideology, even if there's not an obvious point of contact between them and these activists. It's become so powerful. And the sense that to transgress against it is such a incredible sort of moral crime that they fall into line without anyone even really needing to bark orders at them.
Yeah.
And that's something which is going to be really difficult to tackle, because what you're trying to get is to people to overcome that sense of cowardice and trying to dislodge the depressingly rightful sense that this ideology kind of rules the roost, at least in terms of elite institutions. So it's one of those things that makes it incredibly slippery, but also why it makes it all the more important to be on the front foot.
Absolutely.
About it.
Absolutely. But if you can't do that pushback when we're talking about paedophiles, rapists, when we're talking about children and women as victims of crimes, you know, it just shows the sheer scale of the task that's facing us.
Definitely.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.